Thanks for joining us today on CC and Doc Talk, where we talk about everything under the sun. You never know quite what you're going to get, but you'll always be entertained. Today we're discussing Anita Morjani's book, Dying to Be Me. Anita, who suffered from stage 4 cancer, had a near-death experience, an NDE, and during that near-death experience, she was healed of her cancer and came back, chose actually to come back to share her experience. She actually had the option to stay in the beyond, and she chose to come back to share her story and has done so via this book, and she also has a website and some other things. But anyway, we're having this conversation because I read the book and I was really just very impacted by it. And so I asked Amy, Doc, to read the book. And true to form, I read the book in about a day and a half. And Amy has now taken 3 weeks to read the book and highlighted portions. And she's such a good student because I asked her to read the book. So she was taking it, her assignment, very, very seriously. So easy to know why one of us has a PhD and the other one doesn't. Just a clue. I do not have the PhD.
I think it comes down to... You have, in terms of strengths finders, you have input, which is the collector of information. I have learners, so I process when I learn. Same as when you asked me to study the type of therapy that you're doing, and it took me
coherence therapy.
And you know, I took 12 pages of notes so that I could then practice it and implement it into my...
I watched a couple of YouTube videos and said...
And then you said you fast-forwarded through most of it, and I was like taking copious notes. So I got this assignment. Hey, can you read Anita's books? I'm like, sure. I have pages of notes and highlights, and so now in return, I'm going to come back and ask Cindy about some of these themes and concepts. And
she really wants to know why this book impacted me so greatly.
Well, maybe we'll just start with that.
Yeah, just because I have cancer.
Why did this book impact you so greatly?
Well, probably in part because I have cancer, or you know, I've been diagnosed with cancer. I'm fighting cancer, and also because. You know, she was cured, obviously. And, you know, while I don't want to have a near-death experience in order to be cured, which would mean, you know, I'd have to die. I think you and I have always been very fascinated with the afterlife. We have, you know, we have very strong spiritual beliefs around, you know, around source, around universal spirit. We have spirit guides. We know we have angels that are at work in our lives. And so I think you and I have always had a fascination in regard to the supernatural and the metaphysical world. And, you know, this is just more, I guess, evidence for me that exists and that, you know, these amazing miracles happen. And, you know, yes, obviously, you know, in the situation that I'm in right now, battling rectal cancer, I want to know, you know, what are the things that I can do to help, you know, to help heal myself, to help open myself up to, you know, God and universal spirit healing me. And so I think, you know, it definitely did speak to me from that perspective. But also, there were some experiences that she had. Our experiences are very different, but some of her experience is I could relate to. It was very relatable. She's got a new book out now about empaths, and I'll be honest, I was a little put off by her description of empaths as doormats because I'm not that kind of an empath. But you know, you could easily see that she was an empath, and so I kind of relate to that. She talks about the fact that, you know, she realized that her cancer had a mind body spirit connection, and so, you know, her cancer really came about out of, you know, born out of fear and you know, internal struggles and things like that, and I could relate to that. So there are probably a lot of things I related to.
So talk about the cancer being born out of fear, because she talks a whole ton in this book about, in order to not continue to perpetuate the return of the cancer, she has to embrace living fearlessly.
Right.
And that's a really hard thing to do. Because right. there's fear of recurrence, and you're not even through the first round of treatments.
Right.
You haven't even cured it the first time.
Right.
So, I mean, but talk about how fear might have been involved in even creating it to start with.
Well, and in her case, you know, she talks about how she was always afraid of cancer. She was always afraid of cancer. Always afraid of cancer, always afraid of cancer treatments. You know, she had people in her life who were going through cancer treatment, you know, just before she was diagnosed. In my case, I don't know that it was fear, but I absolutely know that there was a mind-body connection in my cancer occurring. And part of that knowledge came from a conversation that I had with a friend who is also a therapist, whose wife also happens to be one of our spiritual guides, our psychic medium, evidentiary medium. And he had a conversation with me shortly after diagnosis, and he talked about the perspective of the mind-body connection and how there's been studies done that there are certain parts of the brain that are connected with certain parts of the body, and they've, you know, made this connection between, you know, events and situations happening that could ultimately lead to cancer. So in my case, colorectal cancer, he said, it usually, especially a tumor, could speak to anger and unresolved trauma, et cetera. And when he said that to me, I immediately went, oh my God, you're absolutely right. Like, it resonated so clearly with me.
Ding, now, ding, this, ding, ding, ding.
Exactly. Like, hello.
Okay. That's it. Yeah.
You know, and not that I'm not blaming myself for cancer. Like, I'm not blaming, you know, my cancer on, you know, but I do know that I think that my emotional state and the things that I was, you know, that I maybe thought I was dealing with, that I wasn't dealing with as well, definitely had to have contributed to a state of stress in my body that caused this tumor, who we lovingly not named Arnold after Kindergarten Cop.
You know, it is not a tumor.
It is not a tumor. Like Arnold came about probably as my body's way of trying to help me cope initially, and now it's trying to kill me. But, you know, it started because, you know, I, as much as I thought that I had, you know, dealt with my father's death and grieved that appropriately, I realized that I was still carrying, you know, some things from that and some trauma from that because it was a traumatic time. And then at layer on top of that, the whole pandemic and COVID situation and my struggle with people's behavior during this whole mess, and, you know, which ultimately really kind of bubbled up in anger and just a constant stress level that you and I are always sort of subjecting ourselves to. I mean, even when, you know, travel and, you know, social events and everything came to a hard stop in March of 2020, I mean, we still had so much stress in our lives and we still create a lot of chaos. And, you know, all of those things were just sort of, you know, simmering under the surface. And then you add a little bit of the empath and the, you know, HSP, highly sensitive person piece to it. And it's just kind of a recipe for disaster, right? So, and, you know, and there is, obviously there is a connection with all of that and in some level of fear and anxiety that just goes hand in hand with all of that. So while I think Anita's experience was really born out of a lot of fear and anxiety and always trying to mold to somebody's expectation of her and always, you know, living what she, I think, referred to as a very inauthentic life, I can't relate to that as much because you and I have always
lived very... She was trying to figure out how she belonged and how she fit right. in with the various cultures.
Right.
Yet yours is... You have always been trying to figure out the perception issue. And at times, you know, you say that you have a committee in your head.
And nobody's the chairman of the board.
You know, which leads to sometimes being just an emotional mess.
Right.
And trying to figure out what emotions are valid, what should be valid and not. And
right.
But the perceptions, you definitely have a thing around perceptions.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that I'm always somebody who worries about what other people think, right? Even when I don't want to, and you know, and I am tremendously self-confident and self-assured until somebody questions me, and then, you know,
are you
and,
sure?
And then I, and the, yeah, and then and that'll be a topic for a different podcast. But, so anyway, I could relate to her just in the sense that I really believe that there was a strong mind-body connection to to Arnold appearing in my life. And, you know, and so that, I guess that's the connection. And then of course, you know, wanting had to have that spiritual, the spiritual impact of being able to be cured if, you know, the right circumstances exist for that in the spiritual realm. So what else do you have highlighted?
Oh, well, now I'm going to have to jump in. It seems a little bit lack of continuity between what you just said. She said, meditation helps us develop the awareness that we are much more than our physical selves. You have been doing a lot of meditation and a lot of healing work. And so what's your thought and reaction to that?
You know, I like to believe in meditation by osmosis, because as you know, I've been doing a lot of that, and I go to bed at night with my, you know, cozy headphone mask on. And, you know, I when I wake up in the middle of the night and the meditation's on, I just kind of jump in, but they always put me right to sleep. So, you know, I like to think that's happening by osmosis. I'm terrible at turning my brain off. I do think that there is a lot to be said for affirmations, which, you know, I think really do affect your subconscious mind and your mindset, sort of, again, kind of by osmosis, sort of the cheater's way of meditating. But I do think that there is some level of self-awareness that helps bring to the table. And like in my case, I think it's also about, you know, finding that inner peace and the positivity, especially on the tough days as we go through this cancer journey. So while I would love to be one of those people who could sit and meditate for hours, you know, with my legs crossed and my hands out and mosquitoes biting me in the middle of a garden and not know the difference, that's not who I am. But I want the inner peace and serenity that brings. So I'm working at it.
Yeah.
Did that answer the question?
Yeah. Well, she talks also about being disillusioned, and she started to question, what am I fighting so hard to keep? What does this all mean? In her pain and fear, I could no longer see the purpose in continuing, and I felt myself getting tired. I was beginning to give up. I was getting ready to admit that I was beaten. How have you, I mean, and you're early in this treatment process, yet there's been moments where you're like, I got this. Oh my gosh.
I don't have this.
Oh my gosh. You know, is this what,
like, holy shit, this is just the beginning.
Oh my.
How am I going to make it?
So talk about just the being disillusioned so early in this process.
And it's interesting because I actually read her book before chemo started. And probably even before my radiation side effects were horrific. Atypical experience, by the way. Not everybody has that experience. Believe it or not, I remember that passage, but I actually related it more to the sort of existential crisis and the crisis of faith that I have had with, you know, the passing of dad and even the passing of grandma and, you know, grandma having dementia. And, you know, it seems like whenever I lose somebody who's very close to me, you know, I have that crisis of faith. And or when you and I watch somebody whom we love and just adore and think is, you know, one of the most amazing people on the planet die of, you know, cancer or some other thing, and we wonder, you know, why bad things happen to good people. I think that's how I can really relate to that being disillusioned. And then certainly now, you know, with the journey of the treatment journey with cancer. Yeah. I mean, there have definitely been a few days when I'm like, I'm not sure who decided that I could handle all this, but they were clearly wrong. and I'm not sure how the F I'm going to get through this, but you know, and then the good days come along and you're like, oh, thank God for the good days. And then you think, okay, I'm going to go back at this next week and start over again. So I don't know. It's,
yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to I'm going to stay on this whole, you know, what caused this, you know, because this is really, you know, the mental struggle of, you know, did I cause this? Did this happen to me? How could bad things happen to good people? And so there's a comment in here. It was then that I understood that my body is only a reflection of my internal state. If my inner self were aware of its greatness and connection with all that is, my body would soon reflect that and heal rapidly. And right before that, she had said, I also understood that the cancer was not some punishment for anything that I had done wrong, nor was I experiencing negative karma as a result of any of my actions, as I previously believed. It was as though every moment had infinite possibilities, and where I was at the point in time was a culmination of every decision, every choice, and every thought of my entire life. My many fears and my great power had manifested as this disease.
The only thing, the only reaction I have to that, and I remember that passage very clearly, is I absolutely 150% resonate with everything she said in that passage.
Interesting.
You know, I might add a couple more emotions to her, you know, comment about fear. But aside, I mean, everything she says in that paragraph, I completely agree with.
Okay. And then, you know, she goes on to continue to, you know, that the purpose of life is to be ourself, live our truth, and be the love that we are.
Yeah. And, you know, I, like I said, I think you and I do a fabulous job of living very authentically. You know, pretty much with most people, what they see is what they get. You know, there's no pretense about us, right? And I think that's why people connect with us, because we are very real. I've never felt like I've lived an inauthentic life. I will, though, say that I can relate to that statement in the sense that I am always seeking, right? I'm always looking for, I'm constantly seeking purpose. You know, and sometimes even when I think I found it, then, you know, later I realize that's not it, right? And so I'm back to seeking purpose. So I think that to some degree, my connection with that part of the book really is around the fact that I've been just searching and seeking and searching and seeking and searching and seeking. You know, how many businesses have I started? How many different paths have I gone down? How many different, you know, avenues have I explored, in part because I do have that committee in my head and there's so many different facets of my personality and I have such a very big, you know, inner imaginative world, but also because I just don't think I've found it yet. And, you know, I always used to say, you don't have to know what you want to be when you grow up. You just have to know what you want to be right now. But I think that the chaos that I've created in always seeking, always looking for the next thing, always pursuing the next creative thing or the next, you know, work thing or, you know, money-making venture, et cetera, I think that chaos has created some level of underlying stress and sort of consternation within me that, you know, culminated with all the other stuff we've already discussed, you know, again, was kind of a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm.
So that relates to her comment. I used to think that the external world was real and that I had to work within its confines.
Yeah.
Are you thinking differently now?
I'm trying. I'm trying. And yet, you know, even during I mean, we're in the middle of freaking cancer treatment and all of a sudden we're like, hey, let's create a podcast. And somehow in my mind, I'm like, you know, on one hand, I'm like, this is a great idea and it would be a lot easier and a lot less stressful and a lot, you know, a lot simpler than so many other avenues that you and I have gone down. And yet on the other hand, I'm like, I'm in the middle of freaking cancer treatment. What the hell am I thinking? You know, because I kept thinking that, you know, I still believe that this is happening to me for a reason and that, you know, that I will know the purpose at some point. And so, you know, like Anita, she realized that she didn't have to go seeking her purpose after she came back from the NDE. She realized it would come to her eventually. And so there's a part of me like questioning even this podcast thing going, am I doing it again? Am I just, you know, am I not waiting and being still long enough? Or is this it? And maybe this is a great distraction, you know, from treatment on the good days, right? Like this is, you and I have conversations like this all the time. Why not? Yeah. Why not share them if it's, you know, if we can do it in a way that's not too, you know, taxing. I don't know. Did I answer?
Well, I mean, I think that was interesting when you and I drove to Alabama to pick up your mom and come back and it's, you know, 20 hours each way, 40 hours round trip. And then we brought her back and so another 40 hours and we were never without conversation.
No.
I mean, we talked the whole time and I know that that some people in your world don't like all my questions and, you know, this deep conversation that we go to on a regular basis.
Basically, however, of our family likes it when we ask powerful coaching questions.
This is how you and I operate on a very regular basis. Totally. So she says, I found that having an inside-out view means being able to fully trust my inner guidance. And she goes on to say, if I'm stressed, anxious, unhappy, or something similar, I go inward and tend to that first. I sit with myself, walk in nature, or listen to music until I get to a centered place where I can feel calm and collected.
And that...
I see you doing that.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to do that. And I have to say, like, that sounds fabulous and easy. It is so not fabulous and easy. That is one of the things that I'm doing right now. I am trying so hard and yet trying not to try so hard to have that inner peace and serenity and to just let shit go and to not be affected by the outside world so much and, you know, kind of really limit the amount of news that I take in and limit the amount of, you know, other people's emotional crap that I take on and really try to be, recognizing that that is not selfish. It's essential. You know, it's not selfish. It's self-love. I mean, if I don't do that, yeah. This tumor, could decide to be three tumors. I mean, I have to change how I react to the outside world. And I totally agree with her. The only way to do that is to work on the inside, but it's not easy, especially when you're used to, having a brain that never turns off and that questions everything and that sees all sides of everything. I can just make myself crazy just sitting here in my head.
Right.
So calming that down and making that quiet it's a feat.
So Anita said she was a people pleaser and feared disapproval regardless of the source, and that she has to detach herself from preconceived outcomes and trust that all will be well.
That's hard too. While I don't relate to that on all accounts, I can say there are lots of people that I could care less if I disappoint, but there are some people that I care very much if I disappoint. So, you know, very, very immediate family is certainly an example. You're an example. You and I have talked about that. You and I work very hard at not disappointing one another. And while, you know, we like to see that as happily codependent, sometimes it's probably not as healthy to trade, you know, our needs for somebody else's. And so that's hard. It's hard. I mean, growth is hard. Self-love is hard.
It is. And she indicated that she needed to forgive herself, not other people. And she was the one that was judging herself.
So I would say I need to forgive myself and other people because, you know, we both know I can be judgy and have opinions. I need to learn how to separate people from their perspective sometimes. I'm actually going to let you speak to that because you and a number of others have brought up my tendency to be hard on myself and why that's so important to get rid of that behavior, especially now. So I think you should speak to that one.
I do see that you are hard on yourself, and I've watched you already really struggle with, you know, you have turned into researcher, a WebMD. the doctors are just impressed
and probably mildly irritated.
But they're just like, it's like, oh my gosh, I don't know that I've ever had a client or a patient that has been this thorough and asked this many questions. I mean, you're trying to dot every I, cross every T, do everything possible to make sure that you do it right. And you want to do it right from the beginning. And when you get conflicting information, it causes a great deal of confusion. And then you get, and you can't just let that go. You can't, because in fact, actually, I'm going to have to scroll back up and find that where she says, as she continued to receive conflicting information and cause confusion, it kind of fuels the fire.
The struggle is real.
The struggle is real. The struggle is real.
Well, and I'll never forget the day that when my sister, you know, my family came here to support me over the holidays, in part because all of our holiday plans got blown up by my diagnosis. And very, very COVID safely. My family came here to support me. And it was so amazing to me. I remember just being dumbfounded the day that my sister said, she goes, you know, she goes, not everybody wants to know all of the details of their diagnosis, of their treatment, of the possible side effects, of what might mitigate them. She's like, some people would rather just trust their doctors and go into this and be basically, you know, ignorant follower. And just be a good, you know, and I don't mean ignorant in a bad way. I just mean, you know, ignorance is bliss in this case. And just, you know, go through it without having any of this knowledge and information. And I remember just like, I looked at her, I'm like, are you kidding? Like, why would somebody operate that way? And she's like, and then I was like, oh my God, she's so right.
I mean, already you have like 6 notebooks, you have spreadsheets, how you communicate.
Hey, you did the spreadsheet.
you put it all together and then I just helped with the formatting. But the amount of over orchestration, some would see it as, but for you, it's a necessity.
Well, it's also trying to control the only pieces of this that I can control, right? So then let's talk about trust and control, right?
Right.
You know, we always talk about trust and control as a spectrum. You know, the more you trust, the less you try to control. You know, the less you trust, the more you try
trust
to control.
You don't trust this process at all and in some ways, you know.
Like, I do on some level. Like, I really do believe that the care team that, you know, that is in charge of my care is competent. I believe they're well-educated. I believe they're experienced. And actually, you know, Anita was talking about in her last email that she sent out about how many doctors don't give their patients hope and they literally scare them to death. And I thought, and first of all, I that never even occurred to me that doctors might do that. And then I realized how truly blessed we are to have a care team who is like, you know, this is serious, but it's not doom and gloom. And, you know, they've given us hope for a cure. And, you know, they're very, I'm like, wow, I didn't realize how blessed we were to have doctors that aren't convincing me I'm going to die every day. And then, you know, but the trust thing, but the control thing, right? So you and I both have a little bit of that. And, I think it just comes out of, you feel so out of control when you get a diagnosis like this and, you know, you want to do everything in your power so you don't die. And so, you know, you do kind of start to over control the things that you can, because you just, we recognize that creates more stress for me. So I've had to back off of that. But it took somebody pointing it out to me, i.e. you and my oncologist, you know, pointing out to me that I wasn't going to be able to control all this. You know, I remember, you know, the doctor saying, he said that day, he goes, you know, I would probably have the tendency to do the same thing that you're doing. And he's like, but at some point you have to let go and you have to have some faith that something bigger than you has got this.
And what did he also say about there's more than one way?
Oh God, there's more than one way to do the right thing. And that, oh my gosh, that just hit me on so many different levels. Like so many different levels.
Because you were trying
so
to find the right way to do this.
To do
the supplements, to prevent the side effects.
To do nutrition.
To be the perfect model patient, get through this the best you can, and with minimal impact.
Right. And of course, all of that was before chemo started. And then we realized that second half of the first chemo week, we realized all of that shit goes out the window because I can't eat. I can't, you know, do anything but sleep. Yeah. I, you know, want to vomit. You know, I mean, you're in the bathroom every 20 minutes. So you realize you can't control any of that shit.
So, yeah. So I want to cover a couple items here. One is, I do want to come back to the food, but I want to, as long as we're down this path for a moment. She said, I still believed that I wasn't going to make it, and I was very, very scared to death. I was scared of dying. And I think, you know, when you first get the cancer diagnosis, I mean, I don't know that you heard it with the same gong bell that I did. It was like my head was right in the middle of Liberty Bell and somebody was beating it. And my knees buckled. It took my breath away.
You were standing behind me. I remember you were standing behind me and I didn't know you were having this experience, but I think it's important that you share that.
Well, and I just turned, I mean, I know, and I almost felt like I was going to faint. I know I went white and I literally had to, we were in the hospital room where you had the colonoscopy. And I stepped behind you and I had to sit down in the chair and put my head down because otherwise I was going to go down. And then later you're like, well, did he say cancer in that room? Like, you might, you know, this is probably going to be cancer. I'm like, yes. I'm like, why do you think I almost just like hit the ground right there? And it took my breath away. It hit me so hard. And I just remember my body turned white. I just drained. And it's like, okay. And so it's like, all right, we can, you know, we're going to figure this out. But I was not prepared for that.
Well, and I think my initial reaction was I heard the word and I was so in my logical brain then, right? Because I was trying to, because he gave us all the good news first. And I think I knew that because he was giving us the good news first, meaning, you know, I didn't have IBS and I didn't have UC, ulcerative colitis, and I didn't have anything going on with my upper GI. I thought, uh-oh, you know, what's coming? And I was so in my logical brain, I heard the word, and then I thought, he's got to be wrong. Like, we both know, like, there was no reason why I should have been diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, having had a clean colonoscopy 2 years ago, even he didn't think that this was going to be the case. Right. And so I don't even know.
There were no indicators, nothing, all the blood work, everything came back clean.
And you said he was,
I think it took him an extra hour to actually come and deliver the news. We were waiting forever because it was just going to be hard news.
And shocking.
Even
for him. So I think when he said the word, I think I was so in my logical brain. I thought, okay, well, just because he found a tumor and he thinks it might be cancer doesn't mean it is, right?
So you went to denial.
So I did go to denial, or at least what I would consider pragmatism. Like, I thought, well, it's in pathology. We don't have any real definitive answers yet. You know, remember, we were calling it benign Betty for the longest, for the time
that we didn't know,
that we had to wait for the diagnosis, because I thought, well, it could still be some just big ass benign fatty tumor. You know, he doesn't necessarily know what he's talking about. They always err on the, they always go to the worst case scenario. So that's what I had in my head. In the meantime, you're like passing out behind me, and I didn't realize. And I don't think it really hit me until you and I spent that whole, because my colonoscopy endoscopy was on a Friday. You and I spent the entire weekend in a puddle of our own tears, essentially.
Well, like, you also came home and did some research and
scared myself to death.
And scared yourself to death because you looked at, you know, the percentage of people who survive these things and what does this mean? And so next thing you know is you and I are, you know, having conversations about updating our wills.
Well,
and
it is a sizable tumor. So, I mean, you know, right there, we ruled out any early stage cancer diagnosis just by the size of the tumor. And so then I was like, holy shit, I'm going to die.
But we did sit and cry the whole weekend.
Right. Right. So. Yeah.
All right. But then we had to switch over to the, we can do this, we believe.
Morbid, and then we switched over to morbid sarcasm.
We did that.
And we got the actual diagnosis. We were so exhausted from our own emotional disasters, our own emotional distress, that we turned to morbid sarcasm humor over the next couple of weeks. And I think that's the only way we survived.
Yeah, it was a survival mechanism. Well, the stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, acceptance. I know there's some others along the way, but you went to denial at first. I about fainted, and then, you know, that the whole,
I think anger really kind of comes and goes.
The anger is, you know, it's kind of like, you know, why do good things happen? And then you realize how many people have cancer. Oh my goodness! Anybody that you talk to has either gone through it themselves, a loved one that's gone through it, somebody that they've lost, somebody that survived it. It's everybody.
Well, and then you go into the infusion center to get chemo and you realize at any given moment, there's like 12 to 16 people in there at any given time rotating in and out. And that's only one infusion center in one city in the United States. I mean, it's horrifying.
Yeah. So eating, I want to come back to the eating part.
That's our favorite topic, eating.
Let me see if I can find the part that she says. I became very stressed about food and was afraid of eating almost anything. I didn't know what was good for me, what wasn't, because each system of healing espouses a different truth, and they all are conflicting with the other all at the same time. They all conflict with one another, and you have run into that as well. Take this for radiation. Don't do this for this one. Don't, you know, do this. So,
and one person says around food, this. The radiologist and oncologist won't agree. So they first they tell you don't eat anything or supplement anything that your oncologists don't agree with, right? But then you realize that the oncologists are very left-brained people. And so, you know, they won't agree to anything unless they have data to support it. And then the problem with that is that when you find data to support it, there's always data that doesn't support it. So there's always conflicting data. But in terms of food, there's a couple of things that just really pop in my head. And you and I just had this conversation the other day. So the first thing is they tell you what they really want you to do instead of supplementing is to get all of your nutrition from food until you realize that once the side effects really kick in, either from radiation or chemo, you can't freaking eat anything. So, you know, I had such severe radiation side effects because I was on a short course radiation protocol, which was 25 days in five. I had an extreme reaction and I ended up on a liquid diet for almost 3 weeks. So couldn't eat anything, right? So then we start chemo and then, you know, the chemo side effects make it so you're not hungry or you want to vomit or you're going to just, you know, it's going to be all diarrhea. So then you realize that the whole idea of getting all your nutrition from food is right out the window. Well, and then let's talk about, you know, all of the things that you and I have done from a healthful perspective before I got diagnosed with cancer and all of the things that we avoided for the last 20 years in order to avoid cancer. And now you get cancer and then you go, well, what the fuck was I not eating that for? You know, I mean, so then the whole thing is just a mind fuck. It really is. It's just a mind fuck. So, you know, it just basically comes down to like, now if the only thing, well, and even the nurse practitioner said, she goes, if you need to eat a box of donuts, you know, to get, to have something in your system, I'm all for that. Now, granted, I would never have been able to eat a box of donuts on a chemo week because that would have just made me sick. But like the idea that, you know, I haven't eaten Pop-Tarts in, you know, 15 years. And now some days the only thing that I can possibly, you know, eat is a Pop-Tart, you know, and, you know, I'm sure that there'd be a million people out there who'd tell me that Pop-Tarts cause cancer or you shouldn't feed sugar to cancer. Well, you know what, at this point, who gives a shit? It's food. And you know, you and I both love food. And so this whole thing is just, it's just a mind fuck.
And now that you're able to, you all of a sudden, like this little magic thing happened in this last few days and you're able to eat. And so what are you realizing? And
I'm able to eat almost anything I want the last few days. And it has been glorious. And so I've realized a couple of things. One is I have this sort of intuitive sense right now that I can look at something and I can sort of smell it and I can go, okay, my body can handle this. I don't know that everybody has that same intuition, but I can do that and it's been working pretty well. Of course, we think my radiation side effects, which were a whole lot of diarrhea, are in the rear view. So that's been very helpful. And then the other thing is, you know, I realized too that because, you know, next week's a chemo week or the end of this week is a chemo week and I'm going to be back in the, you know, feeling crappy mode, I'm now kind of thinking, okay, well, I'm going to eat whatever I can and whatever I want this week. Because if I can't eat next week, I want to be able to go into next week being satiated first and foremost, but then also having nutrients in my body and, you know, being in a better place, physically than I was going into the last round.
So this is, interesting how they say don't lose weight. So the rule of thumb is, you know, you have to move, eat, sleep, and drink a lot of water.
Mm-hmm. The only thing that I think I really managed well was drinking a lot of water and moving when I wasn't on the couch all day.
Yeah, you actually did a good job.
Because I did really well at sleeping. Never mind.
The moving is important because it prevents blood clots.
Right.
And yet, you know, you're going through this treatment, but both of us have lost weight already. I mean, we're 2 months into this and you're down 20 pounds, I'm down 10 pounds. And it's just, I mean, it just isn't it's a highly effective diet, not recommended.
Totally not recommended. And thankfully I had weight to lose. I mean, you know, you and I have always been active and I was so freaking healthy before this tumor was diagnosed. And I never knew I had this big fat tumor sitting in the bottom of my rectum. I felt amazing. And so you and I were really healthy. I mean, we were working out regularly every day for almost an hour, you know, and very active and very healthy in our eating. So yeah, I mean, this just like really threw me for a loop. And, you know, I think both of us probably lost a couple of pounds initially just because of the stress of the diagnosis. But then, yeah, when the radiation side effects hit, you were still eating. I wasn't eating. You were still eating and you were losing weight right along with me, which, you know, just speaks to your metabolism versus mine. So I guess the point to that was, thankfully, I had extra weight to lose. If I had been you, skinny bitch sitting here, you know, and lost 20 pounds, that would not have been a good thing. So, you know, and then this will have to be another podcast, but then we can talk about the mind fuck of, you know, being somebody who's struggled with their weight their entire life. And then you lose 20 pounds literally at the snap of a finger. And then you realize you're not supposed to be losing that weight because you're going through this, you know, a tremendously traumatic experience in your life. But then somehow every time you get on the scale, your brain goes, oh, how do I keep it off? And then you go, no, that's not the right programming I'm supposed to be taking into this. So that's a whole topic for a different podcast.
That is a different one. Which kind of leads into one of her comments where she says, if we stop judging ourselves.
Oh, God, if we could only all stop judging ourselves.
We have to stop judging ourselves before we can stop judging others. And then if we'd stop judging ourselves, we'd automatically find less and less need to condemn others.
Amen. I mean, all I can say to that is amen. She's so right. If we could just, you know, all figure out the magic pill and the magic elixir to make that happen, that would be awesome. And hopefully everybody won't have to get cancer to learn that.
Yeah. And Anita says, this evil is a product of our fears the same way that cancer is.
Right. Right.
It's fascinating. Absolutely. All right. So we're going to close on the note for a moment of talking about living fearlessly. So if I can find her paragraph around how do you live fearlessly? This whole thing is about not being afraid, because when we do things that because we have fear, that feeds the evil beast with us.
Right.
So as I look for the maybe one of the comments that she has, but tell me about this. How do you embrace living fearlessly? What does this look like? Feel like?
Well, I'm gonna start, but then you're gonna jump in. So you're definitely better at living fearlessly than I am. You always have been. But I will say, you know, I've gone through periods in my life where I have done a fabulous job at living fearlessly. Now, you know, I probably need to really spend some time and psychoanalyze myself on, you know, when did I do well at living fearlessly and what caused me to stop doing that? But, you know, I have it in me to live fearlessly. I know that. But sometimes I get to, as you would say, swinging on the branches, off of all the branches on the crazy tree. Mm-hmm. And I go into this sort of spiral
what about this? And what if this happens? Yeah. And what about, you know, and as soon as you kind of get comfort with one little topic, then you jump to another one. And I'm like, oh my gosh, stop. You have to get off this crazy tree.
Right.
You're hanging on the branches of crazy tree and your feet are only 2 inches off the ground.
Right.
And your feet down.
And no doubt I still contend that it's been way worse since menopause, even, you know, being on, you know, compounded bioidentical hormones that are regulating me, you know, quite well. You know, menopause upped the level of anxiety and fear in to a greater degree. And I've seen that in other, you know, my other family members, a couple of my other family members. I think, you know, menopause does crazy things to our body. So if you've got a propensity toward that, sometimes menopause can just, you know, magnify some of that. So I'll just go back to, there have been times in my life when I know I've done a great job of that. I would like to figure out and capture whatever it is that allowed me to do that at those times in my life and be able to find a way to replicate that, more frequently and more often in my current life. And like I said, you're a great example of living fearlessly. So I actually want you to speak to how you managed, because I think, you know, as we know, as coaches, you know, it's always easy to know what you need to do. The how is significantly harder. So, Amy, how do you live fearlessly?
Well, I think part of that's in my DNA and my temperament. And yet, you know, I lost a sister at a young age. And I realized that, you know, you have to prepare for tomorrow in case there is one. But in case there isn't one, you only get one shot at this. And so, you know, being able to travel at a younger age and get out there. And, you know, sometimes I was extremely broke, but I still jumped in the car and went if that's what I wanted to do. Because 90% of what we worry about doesn't happen. And so we spend all this energy putting together scenarios of what's the worst case that can happen. And guess what? 99% of those don't happen. And the one thing that you didn't think of might have happened, you know? You know, I'm out there having a good time. Well, I didn't think I was going to get arrested for being naked on the beach or something like that. I mean, it's not the thing that I prepared for, but that might have been the one thing that would happen. And so, you know, you can waste a lot of mental energy on all these things that don't happen. But, you know, there's other things that will happen. And you just have to have the self-confidence and the ability to know that when they come up, you're going to have to handle them. You and I didn't prepare for, you know, our whole life for how are we going to deal with cancer. It never crossed our mind. Right. So we
that was not the thing. We were preparing for heart attacks and
diabetes
and you know,
all these other things. So the one thing we didn't prepare for was how to deal with cancer. So we're starting from scratch.
Yeah.
Right. And it's the one thing that served us. So we could have spent all of our time worrying about these things and they don't happen. So when they do happen, you have to know that you can have the courage and the wherewithal to then deal with it at the time and get through it.
And, I mean, and you make such a really good point. And I do think temperament has a lot to do with it. You know, you do have a temperament. And again, another podcast topic. You do have a temperament that allows you to take more risks without overthinking the consequences. You know, again, risk-taking, not reckless. I happen to have, you know, multiple temperaments in me. We call it the chameleon or multiple personality disorder. And so that committee in my head definitely lends itself to more of that, you know, kind of worry mindset, because I think of all the different angles and possibilities and how do we troubleshoot this before it happens and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that committee really is sort of, you know, they're a blessing and a curse. So temperament definitely is a part of it, but you make such a good point. Like, we prepared for so many things based on family history, right? And you're the one with family history of colon cancer, and I'm the one that got it.
Of all people, I have been worried about getting through my 50s clean of colon, at least to 55, and I'm about to turn 56, so I did it, right? Of getting through that because, you know, I have family history. My grandmother died of colon cancer. My uncle he didn't die. I mean, he's had like 30 years survivor.
I think it's 20 some,
almost, yeah. 30. Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, it's in my family. So it's always been in the back of my mind. Do my colonoscopies young, you know, whatever it is, don't ignore any symptoms. And
which we did.
And so boom, all of a sudden you get it. I'm like, what? And so anyway, all right, we're going to wrap here. And so I'm going to end on two quotes from Anita. I am most powerful when I am working with life rather than against it.
Amen.
And if I care for myself, then I automatically feel the same for you.
Yeah.
And she says to live fearlessly.
Which is why self-love is more important than anything. We have to stop telling people that they're being selfish when they take care of themselves. Because if you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of others. And if you don't love yourself first, you don't have that to share with anybody else. Yeah. It's so true. It's so elementary, and yet it's so hard.
So I want to thank you, Cece, for your sharing of this journey and being open to this conversation. Thanks for the assignment of reading this book. So to encourage you to live fearlessly and believe.
And practice self-love and love yourself today more than anybody else so that you can love everybody else. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to Cece and Doc Talk. We'd love for you to follow us on social media at Cece and Doc. That's CCNDOC. And you can visit our website at cceanddoc.com. We also take monthly donations to support this broadcast if you're so inclined. We'd love to hear your comments, suggestions, and questions, and we'll do our best to respond. Thanks, and have a fantabulous day.